FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Edward Lear in Malta, New Revelations. This talk is delivered by Professor John Variano.
Good evening. It is a great pleasure to introduce, for the third year running, Professor Variano to this numerous audience. It is no secret that Professor Variano loves our islands and keeps returning annually to spend time researching in our archives and contributing to our heritage by sharing with us the fruits of your research. John has also very kindly agreed to guest curate not only Fondazione Patrimonio Maltese forthcoming exhibition on still lives, but also the Palazzo Falson exhibition on Edward Lear that is slated to open later this year. We are lucky to benefit from his in-depth research and fascination with this important Victorian artist, and today's lecture will actually give us a preview ahead of the exhibition. Next week, John will also be delivering a private lecture exclusively for friends of Palazzo Falson regarding the artist as critic in Baroque Rome. And now a few words about our guest speaker tonight. John Variano is Professor Emeritus of Art History at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Since receiving his PhD, he has written books on Italian Baroque architecture, The Taste for Travel in Rome, The Realism of Caravaggio, The Appetites for Food and Art in Renaissance Italy, and The Cultural History of Wine. His latest research focuses on the work of Edward Lear in Malta and in the Holy Land. Over to you, John.
Well, thank you, Francesca, for the gracious introduction, and thank you so much for being my perfect collaborator on the Lear exhibition. We can't wait to see that happen. And thank all of you for turning out on another night like this. Seems every time I speak in Malta, I bring the bad weather from Massachusetts with me. So I'm really privileged to have the opportunity to share with you this evening some of the research I've done, some of the meditations which I've done about Edward Lear, which begin, I think it's very proper that we have this image as on the poster, because it was this image in Palazzo Falson that I first noticed. It was only 2 years ago when I had my first tour of Palazzo Falson, and I saw it on the wall, and I thought it was one of the most beautiful watercolors I'd ever seen by Edward Lear. I'd been following Lear, going to Lear exhibitions all over the world, and I had forgotten that he had been to Malta. And it was with great enthusiasm that I looked into this further and discovered that no book or catalog had ever been written of Edward Lear's work on the island of Malta. So it was one of those epiphanic moments, which happen only too rarely in the life of a scholar, that starting with this work, we would try to unravel the mysteries of this man who you see in a portrait here looking a bit like a Victorian dandy. This is a photograph made about a year after he was in Malta, and it shows him posed in the studio. He's a very complicated person, and I think people know maybe more about him from his odd biography and from some of his other activities, more so than from his work as an artist. He himself, however, took himself most seriously as a painter, and he painted numbers of works which we'll be looking at today, many of them painted in Malta. He also was a very gifted writer, and more of his production is probably known to more people, I would imagine, for the publications that he had. These books, which included 14 books on natural history, 4 books of nonsense verse, the kind of verse which later came to be known as the limerick, 6 travel books, and then the works of art, hundreds of paintings, probably about 300 paintings, and literally thousands of watercolors. The last estimate that's been made of how many watercolors did Edward Lear actually paint in his lifetime is about 7,000. So he was a very industrious chap, worked very, very hard. And I want to spend just a couple of minutes recounting the background before we get to Lear as an artist here in Malta. His first activities, as it showed any artistic talent at all, was his ornithological illustrations, which he made in London and published a book in 1832. He was 19 years old when he completed this book, 20 years old when it was published. And among ornithologists, Lear is celebrated for being the first artist to actually depict these rare species of birds from life. He didn't work from stuffed birds and worked in a laboratory of taxidermists, but he actually painted birds from life, and they're very, very beautiful. They're hand-painted lithographs, and if you ever come across any of these in shops and so forth, buy them, because the market is increasing rapidly for Lear's birds. The natural history books occupied him mainly through the 1830s into the 40s. Then he became interested and began writing books of poetry and this nonsense verse. He called it nonsense verse. And one you're perhaps familiar with, the owl and the pussycat in children's books. But he wrote thousands of these things. There was an old lady whose folly induced her to sit in a holly, whereupon by a thorn, her dress being torn, she quickly became melancholy. He just scribbled these things off on cocktail napkins. And I don't think he ever took it that seriously, although he realized wherever there is a potential market, he would pursue it. And Lear is one of those artists who is not unmindful of the need to make things that people wanted and were willing to pay for. And part of his Maltese experience, as we'll see, is how that market reacted to him and how he in turn reacted to it. So there are numerous of these before books of this, and the verse itself has been collected by that great scholar of Edward Lear, Vivian Noakes, the late Vivian Noakes, unfortunately, and one of her many volumes on Lear, is this volume, The Complete Verse, 448 pages of it, some of it illustrated with cartoon-like sketches. Very, very amusing book. It's the sort of thing, if you have any grandchildren, say, in your lives, rather than giving them more video games, give them this book. This should excite the appetites of youngsters, or youngsters of all ages, really. And then we finally come to what will occupy us a bit more here today, is his travels. And he was an inveterate traveler, always on the move, from London originally, didn't care much for London. He described London in one letter as, he called it Fogopolis. He didn't like the damp, he didn't like the cold, he didn't like the people, he didn't like the food. He was constantly on the move, especially in the colder, damper winter months. And his passport bore stamps from all of these countries, and many of those trips, including the one to Malta, were repeated trips. He didn't go to Corfu only once. He didn't go to Malta only once either. So he was constantly on the move and always with a mind to how can he make this pay for his own expenses. And he produced then six travel books during his lifetime. There are other travel books of Edward Lear which you can buy today in modern editions. But during his lifetime, died in 1888, he did three books of journals. Journals are books which are based upon his meticulous diaries that he kept day by day. And as we're going to look at some of the diaries, the Maltese diaries, in a few moments, there's all kinds of personal information in there. And Lear had the good sense, I think, when he went to his publisher, not to include all the personal information, his mood swings. He had a tremendously moody character. But to kind of clean up the accounting and the narrative, and to include, as in this Corsican book, some either line drawings or engravings. He even experimented with photography as a way of reproducing his own paintings. And so we have three books for Albania, for the southern Calabria, the south of Italy, and for Corsica. He also did three other books, which are larger folio volumes of illustration, where the text is minimal and the image is the main point. And those were for Rome, one for Rome, one for Italy, and the Ionian Islands. Now, part of Lear's industriousness when he goes to these places, like Malta, was, I think, with the idea of a book publication in mind, just waiting to meet someone who said, I like your work here, we would like to publish it, you can have a royalty for it. Turns out that didn't happen in Malta. It didn't happen in most of the places he went. And so the books that have been written about Lear's travel to different places have mostly been produced in the 20th century. And I'm proud to say our Fondazione's book on Malta will be really the last place that Lear went, which has not been treated to an academic monograph or an academic exhibition. It's a terrible lacuna, I thought, which just made me even more enthusiastic about pursuing the study. Now, what do we know about Lear up to this point? The primary sources on Edward Lear are really quite limited mainly to two books that were published in the first decade of the 20th century, both of them edited by Lady Strachey, and their letters in, Lear wrote letters constantly. He'd write 8 to 10 letters a day, the way people nowadays write emails, I suppose. He wrote these long letters. The only letters that are preserved in a public place where you could find them were the letters he wrote to a friend, Chichester Fortescue, and to a lady friend, Countess Waldegrave. And he was good friends with the two of them. In fact, he actually pushed the two of them into a marriage. And Lady Strachey published two volumes, the earlier letters and the later letters. And it's based on these letters and a few snippets of diaries that were recorded mainly by Vivian Noakes, who had to make the trip to Cambridge, Massachusetts to look at the diaries, that we've been able to determine who he was and what he thought and what some of his interests were. So the new revelations, which I have as the title for this talk, is composed really of two particular sources, primary sources. And the first of them we're going to look at are the volumes of diaries themselves. These are in bound books that are about this large, very cramped handwriting, tedious transcription. It took me months to transcribe the 3 months that he spent in Malta. His handwriting is terrible. And it's subject to all kinds of emotional moves in his own life. He also frequently switches into another language altogether. And his favorite language to switch into is Greek. And so I had to then hire a Greek translator to read some of the Greek. Some of it's in Italian, which I could handle. French words in there. He's very, very erudite and curious guy. There are 30 volumes of these unpublished diaries that still exist at the Houghton Library at Harvard. He had written about 60 volumes of the diary. The first 30 volumes were destroyed by one of the two executors of his estate, and because it may have had some compromising information in them. It's a great tragedy. We have no real intimate knowledge of how Lear spent his days before 1858. But fortunately, his major trips to Malta happened after 1858, and we can look at pages like this. This is a typical page, two pages, so it's a front and back, of Lear's diary to Malta. It's January 6th of 1866, right after he arrived here. Now, we look at these pages of the diary. And what are the revelations? They're really order of five different ways of learning things about him. One is the diaries tell you where he spent his time. Where did he go? What did he do when he got there? When did he draw? When did he not draw? What did he have for breakfast? What did he have for lunch? Who did he dine with in the evening, if he dined with anyone? And very, very helpful in trying to unify the expression of this man in the verbal side here and the visual side in the watercolors. So one of the things I was especially interested in was to look at the very top lines. He always begins, he tells you what time he got up in the morning, a totally useless bit of information, but he also tells you what the weather was like. And Lear's painting is very weather-dependent, I suppose, like any plein air painter, it's going to make a big difference whether it's a calm and sunny day or it's a very windy and tempestuous day. And then he adds also off to the right there, I drew. And frequently within each diary page, he'll tell you what he drew or where he went and how many drawings he made at that time. So it's a relatively simple matter once you gather up the visual material to put it together with this verbal material and find out more about who he was with and what conditions pertained and so on. The other thing which we find out, which is, I think, very useful in interpreting his art on some occasions, is how he felt himself. Lear was a bit of a hypochondriac, but he did have some real ailments. And to name them alphabetically, I believe they start with asthma, chronic bronchitis, depression. He had problems with vision, which grew increasingly worse as he became older. Syphilis. I wonder how did he get that when he was 21 years old. But most significantly, what kept Lear off balance more than anything else, as you see here, he says, total upset of system, cold and wretched night. And then at the next page, we're looking at miserable, rather, yet resolved, underlined three times, to get through the day. This was an unhappy day. Why was the day so unhappy? Look down here. You see three X's, and within a parenthesis, the number 2. These are the records of his epileptic seizures. And he kept this code for himself, did not share it with many people, and there's good reason to think that the reason, there might be several reasons, but one of the reasons that Lear never married, although he frequently talks about wanting to be married, is that the epilepsy he suffered was his dark, dark secret, what he called the demon or the morbids. And he often could sense one coming on, and that's when he would frequently just absent himself from public and from company. So those X's refer to the intensity, and the numbers refer to the frequency of them. So when you see triple X 2, that's a fairly high order of intensity, and it happened twice. And some of these, as one day, you can see we had the highest level of intensity 7 times. Needless to say, that was a day he did not paint a single watercolor. He had seizures on 42 of the days he was in Malta, and those, as you might expect, would have been his least productive days. So, again, the alignment of what he says in the diary and what he paints on paper is very intriguing. Now, the other thing which I find interesting about Lear's diary is it tells you more about the company who he keeps. And for dinner, he doesn't do this for lunch, although he sometimes attends luncheon parties. For dinner, he draws the shape of the table. It's not always round, and it's not always the same size. It's sometimes rectangular. And he puts himself EL at one position. And then he puts the names of everyone who he's dining with. This night, on the 6th of January, he had 3 companions. He had more companions the other night. Now, when you look at those names, it lets you know who he was spending his time with. It also tells you who he was not spending his time with. And I found that perhaps even more intriguing. The people he was spending all of his time with in this island were officers in the Navy or the British Army, and they all were captains or colonels, or General Ridley was a great party giver, and he had dinner at General Ridley's house repeatedly in Valletta while he was here. He sees himself next to Ridley. And do you see any Maltese names on these dinner lists? Very, very rarely in all of the dinners he attended during this most fertile period, and he's in Malta, 1865-66, he dined with exactly 2 Maltese people. One, his name is on this sheet, actually, Count Zurb, and the other on one occasion only with Adrian Dingley, who was the crown advocate at that time, and would go on to be the Chief Justice of the Maltese court. He did not pursue Maltese friendships. And apparently the Maltese did not pursue him. So he stayed with a coterie of countrymen, as he often did in other places, the main difference being in the other places where Lear worked, the other corners of the British Empire, there were often swells on the Grand Tour or aristocrats who were wintering in some lovely place, had a fair amount of disposable cash to pass around and bought his work. These military men, and you don't see many women at these tables either, Lear, if nothing else, I think we could agree upon, was rather intensely homosocial, if he was not homosexual. They weren't buying his work. That just wasn't the world that they were in, particularly. And so this is revealing. You can make a list of all the dinner parties that Lear attended. Now, finally, which is also kind of amusing, at the end of each diary book, one volume per year for the 30 years it survived, are his expenses. On the left side of the page is his income, some of it from fixed assets back in London with a banker by the name of Drummond, Edmund Drummond. And below this, usually, although I see not in this particular sheet, the sale of his works of art and to whom he sold them. So an invaluable bit of information as to who bought these paintings and what they paid for them. And one could, looking over a span of 30 years, see the conditions of the market changing, his works becoming more or unfortunately less valuable as time went on. On the right side of the ledger, is his list of expenses. And he was, I mean, to put it mildly, a rather frugal individual, and he accounted for every single penny that he spent. And this page in January recounts what he had spent the previous month checking out of the hotel he had been staying in Venice. He stayed at the Danieli, which is not such a shabby place for a starving artist. He stayed at the Danieli, you can see, and then he had to get himself across from Venice all the way over to the Mediterranean side, over to Marseille. That cost him £15. Then he bought, and these are dates, the 2nd of the month, the 3rd, 4th of the month, the 6th of January, he bought the ticket to Malta, and that cost him £10, and so on. He was a miserly tipper. He did tip some of the people on the boat. The boat was called the Puna, and so on, expenses in quarantine. And then the rent that he paid for a house that he rented over in Sliema. And so forth. Some of the other expenses at the bottom are for people who assisted him. He had a young lad by the name of Francis, who was his Maltese assistant. He schlepped things around for him and carried cases of Marsala back to the house. And his main assistant, who he spent many, many years with in many, many countries, Giorgio Cotali, was the Giorgio who's been referred to here on several occasions. Advanced to Giorgio, ditto, another payment to Giorgio. Giorgio did all the shopping, grocery shopping, all of the food preparation, and accompanied Lear on his sketching trips, carrying all this equipment along with him. Now, the other source of revelation, which unfortunately we can only do in these days, and my predecessors who have looked at Lear's work, one of whom is in this audience tonight and made a contribution of the time, is the resources of the internet now make it very easy to track works of art, and track almost anything if you like. The easiest way to track works of art, I mean, it's really kind of a no-brainer, is to go on Google Images and type in Edward Lear Malta, and all kinds of stuff comes flying out. Attributions to him, often they're replicas, and a lot of them are commercial sites trying to sell you a hand-painted oil painting from a Lear watercolor. I came across an ad for a cell phone cover that had a Maltese watercolor on it. That's fairly common with the Google Images. The one that's less common that the serious people in this business use is museum curators and dealers and high-end collectors is ArtNet. This is a subscription service. It's not cheap, but it tells you what's going on in the auction world. So if you're thinking about buying anything in the art world, it'd be worth looking at the ArtNet and seeing what comparable items sold for within recent years. Now, if you go back and do a search, I'm not a member of ArtNet, but I happen to be married to a museum curator who has the subscription, and I often poach over on her desk. And what I found is 34 views of Malta have been sold at auctions since 1989, and ArtNet also tells you what the price was as well, if you're interested in keeping track of the market in that sense. The other source of visual material on which I relied is the increasing number of websites attached to museums which actually do have catalogs of all their work. And here I can say somewhat chauvinistically, the United States is far in the lead in doing this, in cataloging entire collections, making them available in high-resolution photographs online. Part of this is just a simple legal reason, because in the United States, to my opinion, we have a very enlightened system whereby works of art in the public domain, which are flat, as in watercolors, photographs, drawings, are not copyrightable, and no rights pertain, and you can publish any of them you like, in any format you like. You can make coffee mugs and book bags and so forth with any of these images you see here from Yale or from Harvard. And that's not a misprint. Harvard Houghton Library has 3,529 works by Edward Lear, and they're perfectly cataloged. They're all beautifully high-resolution images, and it doesn't take a lot of work, although it takes a fair amount of time, to go from, Antwerp to Zagreb through the world's museums to see what they own, if there are any Edward Lears. More often than not, the works wouldn't be illustrated, but there's a way to at least find out if they own anything, and then you rely on the old-fashioned manner of sitting down writing a letter to the museum and hoping that you get an answer that may have a photograph tucked into it. So that's part of the new material, is just gathering together all of this stuff that is available now online. Because I was so persistent with Harvard about the diary and asking them to microfilm it for me page by page, they finally agreed to scan the entire thing. And the entire Edward Lear diary from 1858 until 1888 is scanned and is now publicly available. Not such an easy website to get into, but once you're there, you can read stuff like that page to your heart's content. Now, in Malta, he, of course, passed through here on many occasions, as did so many other grand tourists and the like. Where you see Malta stamped in a passport doesn't necessarily mean that was his final destination, but often was the stopping point for someone on their way to Greece or to the Middle East or even farther south of that and to Africa. So the first trips, 1848, twice, 49, 53, he was just changing boats or stopping for water. Same thing Napoleon did in that fateful stop in 1798. The longest time he spent among the early trips is 1862, where the boat arrangements weren't as he thought, and he decided to wait for later boats. So he had 10 days here in 1862, less than a day or two on those other trips. And the 10 days in 1862 led him to think this might be an interesting place to spend the winter, climate-wise and scenery-wise. And so this last trip, 1865-66, from December until April, is where the bulk of this material that we'll eventually be looking at that happens to come from. And this is, of course, a map that is probably the map that he actually had. Now, I owe to my colleague, Catherine Gallia, who's sitting here with a big smile on her face, the identification of this funny little building over in Sliema, which I thought had been destroyed during the modernization of Salema. In fact, Francesca and I went out looking for it one day, and we came to the conclusion it's gone. There's got to be a high-rise there instead. But Catherine told me one evening, no, it's just around the corner from some joint we're having pizza, I think. And we walked around the corner to St. Anne's Square, and lo and behold, there it was. It doesn't have a plaque on the wall that says Edward Lear lives here. It's now a Western Union office, and it's been a bit tarted up around the front and so forth. And the square itself has changed character considerably since the time that he was resident. You can look at some old maps and see the house here at the end of Via dei Torri. There was a central fountain and pretty clear access to the waterfront. I've flipped this map so it's reading the way we're looking at above. Since that time, of course, Salema has been developed, the Strand has been built, and that house is much farther from the water than it originally was. And I think this is important because in that house, from those windows and from his balcony, Lear painted a great many watercolors from different times of day, sometimes different angles. Sometimes he moved around a bit on the ground. And we're fortunate that in the diary for the 18th of December, right after he moved in a couple of days, he drew a ground plan of the house, the two stories of the house that he occupied. Entering on the ground floor, the point which I found most notable is the largest room in the ground floor he labels gallery. And on the upper floor, the most interesting room, I see he names balcony, where this corner had canted off to one side. And it's undoubtedly from this very balcony that Lear painted many of the watercolors that survive from this period. Now, the way he kept himself occupied in Malta was when the weather permitted, he went out and traveled a bit. The guidebook I assume he was using, I can't prove this, was George Percy Badger's Malta and Gozo, first edition, 1838, renewed editions. The latest edition that Lear would have had access to is the 1858 edition. It was published by Muir, and there is an account in his account books that say he bought maps and books at Muir's bookstore. So was this the book? I think it's probably fairly likely. Is this the map? Yeah, this is the 1865 version of the famous Brockhorst map. So here he is down in Salema. He was over to Valletta a fair amount. Many of those dinner parties he attended were in Valletta. But how does he occupy himself in the winter months? Well, there's his servant, Giorgio Coccale, who's going to play a part in this story. How he occupied himself in these winter months, that's not the Grand Harbor. That's Venice. He spent almost 3 months when he arrived here in December, January, February, not until the beginning of March, completing an oil painting, which was commissioned by his friend Lady Waldegrave. And he talked us every single day in the diary. You know how many hours he put into this each day. Personally, I think this painting is a bit overlabored. But he finally crated it up, and it got sent out on the 3rd of March, just about the time the weather was getting better, and he himself was able to move around the island a bit. Now, he walked almost everywhere, and in Malta it's possible to walk great distances, cover a lot of ground. Occasionally, he would hire a cart, a horse-drawn cart, a donkey or a horse. This is the old Giorgio Sommer photograph that was made of a Maltese caless. And he would bargain relentlessly with the driver to try to drive the price down. And he was enormously proud of himself when he got a deal on the horse. He wrote that in his account book, too. I got him down from 4 to 3.5. And he traveled this way, often taking only as far as Medina, Civita Vecchia, as he calls it, and then walked the rest of the way, frequently walking from here to the coast. And most of his coastal explorations he loved to draw, he did on foot. There was another form of transportation available, which he took advantage of. On the occasion when he went to Gozo for 10 days in March, later part of March, and this was the Omnibus, which is a horse-drawn vehicle with four wheels, and he made his way across it. That was a regularly scheduled service. The only problem was there are certain points on this journey that when there are four people and all their luggage, the horses couldn't pull, and they had to get out and walk anyway. And so he complains about that. If there's anything Lear can complain about, he will not miss the opportunity. So his diary is full of complaints about the guy who drove the horse was lazy, the animals were old, that sort of thing. But that's how he covered much of the island. He did not like boats. Really did not like boats. How did he get from Sulema to all those dinner parties he attended at the palace in Valletta? Did he take the little ferry across the channel? Once or twice he did. He did it on very calm days, made him nervous, had no desire to do it anymore. And almost all of the trips that he made to Valletta, he made on foot, walking around the bay. And I can imagine, how he got home at night after the description of some of the activities at those dinners in Valletta. But he liked boats. He liked to draw boats. And in Gozo, he just had a feast of boats. There are numerous drawings like these. Most of them are in the Royal Maritime Museum in Greenwich, and there are some in other places that show these boats and their beautiful colors and shown in different directions. And even later on, he was in some place, I've forgotten, 1867, 68, where he didn't like the boats at all. And he wrote something in his diary, boats here aren't nearly as beautiful as they were in Malta. So he was drawn to this as not as a personal means of transportation, but as an object of some beauty. And Gozo was where he found most of the boats that he liked. Now, I want you to read this section, which tells us more about Lear's working method. Really tells you everything you need to know about Lear's working method. In a nutshell, this explains Edward Lear. And it was written by a guy who accompanied, this was an essay accompanied in the second volume of letters published by Lady Strachey, the later letters of Edward Lear. And she, Lady Strachey, asked Hubert Congreve, who had been a much younger friend of Lear's and had traveled with Lear, to write an appreciation of his art, which in some ways is a rather backhanded compliment to Lear. It wasn't all that positive if you read it. But what's most useful about Congreve's comments, he talks about the working method, how they went on expeditions walking along with Giorgio, George's assistant, carrying the lunch and all the materials on his back until they came to a good subject. Lear would sit down, gaze for several minutes at the site, remove his spectacles, and look through a monocular glass, adjusting it until he got the right view in mind. Then he sat down to do the work. They were always done in pencil, and then inked in sepia and brush washed with color in the winter evenings. Lear's watercolors are actually a three-step process. And when you see them, don't be puzzled by them. They usually do, the on-site watercolors all have dates. Don't be put off by the fact that they have two different dates. The first date is the date on which he made the drawing, and then Giorgio carried it home. That evening, if he wasn't attending a dinner party, over copious amounts of Marsala was his drink of taste, he would ink them in. He calls in the diary penning in. Penning in means with a fine pen going over the pencil lines and often erasing, but not so successfully erasing, the pencil lines underneath. That's the second process. The third process, which was not necessarily that same night, but it could be sometime later, Congreve says, in the winter months, much later, where he would add the color. So you have, as part of the creative process of Edward Lear, part of the mind which is thinking in terms of classical drawing, or disegno, if you will, and another part of his mind which is quite separate from that, which is thinking in terms of passages of color and fields of color. So that is, I mean, it's something you can sense intuitively from looking at the watercolors themselves, but here Congreve actually tells you that, and he had been with Lear on sketching expeditions. Lear also, just when I started to find this man so grumpy and so uncharitable and often so cantankerous and such a curmudgeon, he would put into the diary or at the bottom of the letter an absolutely charming little self-caricature of himself doing something, looking kind of globular and egg-like. This is one that he made later in life, and gained some weight by then. He's got the glasses off and the monocular lens. There are other sketches like this in the diary and in various letters. On 30th of May in 1862, he's complaining that he needs a haircut. He said, my hair is just growing so bushy, it's impossible. On the 29th of January of 66, he has a terrible head cold. He said, my nose feels like it's going to explode. And then on a very grumpy day, the 13th of February of 66, he decides he's really tired of Malta. And he says, I wish I had the wings of a bird and could fly away. And that's what explains why he's got these webbed feet and little wing-like apertures. This is charming stuff. And you see that Lear's work, just from looking at it, bears out his own self-appraisal, where he wrote of himself one time in a moment of self-reflection. It had a queer, natural mercuriality of temperament. He could go from being the most cantankerous individual imaginable to someone who is almost childlike. He liked playing music. He liked setting some of his poems to music and so on. A very mixed personality. I'm not sure spending a whole weekend with him would be such a great idea, but maybe a lunch. I had lunch with Edward Lear, pick up some drawing tips. And the watercolors on site begin, the earliest one I've been able to identify, turned up in the auction rooms a couple of years ago in London. This is the 1854 watercolor, and then a couple more from the 1862 trip are known. And these do not have the kind of writing on them which describe the place and the time of day and so on that most of them do. So if you find it a Lear that doesn't have that kind of information right on the surface, not necessarily wrong, it might be an earlier Lear. I only know two watercolors from 1854 and two from 1862. After several days of rain when he arrived here in 62, the sun came out one afternoon. He went up to the Barocca Gardens, the upper gardens, and he drew, and it really becomes poetic and evoking what that place was like with the glistening light and the transparency. And interestingly, he doesn't look at the most monumental structure, which is off to the left here, Fort San Angelo, instead he does Fort St. Michael, but he captures what he describes in words, which is the glimmering effects of light on the water and these little boats that look like water bugs flying around. This sets the stage. In fact, I would have to say this particular day on the Barocca Point in 1862 was what made him decide to come back for a winter when he could, and that in turn leads to the 65-66 trip. Now, one thing which occurred to me, if you look at the materials that 19th century artists carried with them when they traveled, they usually carried sketchbooks or illustrated notebooks. These are two, the one on the left is practically invisible. They're both by J.M.W. Turner, the great artist of the century in England. And you see on the right, especially, it's more visible, that for Turner, there was no contradiction between words and images, that he uses the two, words and images, almost interchangeably. He writes something, then he illustrates it, then writes something longer and illustrates it. So in one place, we have the experience of Turner. Lear thought of these as two very different parts of the brain. When he's sitting down to write, it's one mindset. When he's painting, it's another mindset. And Lear's watercolors come in all different sizes and shapes, and there's a reason for that, as I'll mention in a moment. They have a freshness about them. The preliminary ones, the on-site watercolors, have a freshness that almost reminds us of the impressionist sensibility, which was becoming current in European art around this time, the 1860s and 70s. It is a sensitivity to light and a sense of the flickering light and quick passages of color. Now, to look at Lear from an art historical perspective, which is what I'm trained to do, is to see him positioned somewhere between being unique in doing so, but somewhere between the school of linear painting, the so-called tinted drawing, which is very common in England at the end of the 18th and early part of the 19th century, was basically a drawing, and the line defines the shape, and the color is clearly secondary. On the one hand, this is like the old disegno idea of Italian Renaissance art, or Florentine Renaissance art, that line is primary, line is everything, line is reason, line is intellectual. Color, on the other hand, is something that's a little bit hard to put your finger on. It's Turner, in this beautiful watercolor, exemplifies that other way of thinking about art, the atmospheric effect. There are really no lines in the picture. It's truly a painting of watercolor with a brush. And Lear is somewhere between these two categories. There's a lot of line in the original drawing. The line is reinforced later on in ink. And if you look at where the passages of color are, they're not what we could call local color, which are bound to a particular part of the image. But the color seems to spread, almost like you can think of watercolor spreading over a page, over terrain that's clearly of different types. And this is kind of his secret, this the tinted drawing that has some color and light to it. Now, the further evidence that Lear worked on these things at different times is this beautiful drawing made from somewhere very near his house, looking over to Manuel and to Valletta, which is full of inscriptions in his hand, which, of course, tell you some basic information like the place, the date, January 19th, 1866, 5:30 p.m. Very meticulous in dating these things. But then there's a dash, March 12th, 6:30. That means he worked on this twice. They did the drawing first, and then on March 12th, clearly, he went back and added the color. And for that reason, we frequently find in Lear watercolors color notations which he made on plain paper to himself, suggesting that, well, here it says Manuel Island is the darkest, and then the sky is clear with lemon-orange sky, lemon light. And when he's back in the studio with a glass of Marsala in his hand, then he's painting lemon light. This is all kind of added from his imagination and from his memory. The drawing portion is really done empirically on the site. Now, this has nothing to do with Malta, but I'm sort of amused. I thought it'd be interesting to see that Lear made 5 watercolors in Egypt within a 40-minute period early in the morning in February of 1867. 8 minutes per watercolor. And some of these, which he dates, you can see only took 5 minutes between 4:20 and 4:21. Or from 4:21 to 4:22, 5 minutes. How could he paint that in 5 minutes? The answer is he just did the drawing. He didn't paint it in 5 minutes. He probably spent an hour or two with his colors later on. So again, this is sort of discordance, disruption in his creative process. Lyra watercolors come in many different sizes. I don't know why he didn't use sketchbooks. They were certainly available. Turner used them. They come in all different sizes, and often intrigued, why did he choose a particular size and a particular format? Dar Hassan is a relatively large format work. The one he did over in Gozo, number 192, is a very small work. This is where having the diary at hand when you're looking at the images tells you a lot. Because the day he was doing Dar Hassan was a day with less wind and a prospect of a fine day. He could take a big piece of paper and put it on a board and it wouldn't blow into the water. It wouldn't blow all over the place. When he's over in Gozo, the wind was too terrible and I could do little. He could do a little more than paint something that was postcard size. So there's a certain amount of realism to this. Now, all of these on-site watercolors were not done as ends in themselves, even though we, I speak to the sensibility of our own time, like the freshness, the spontaneity, the immediacy of these works. He, in turn, was thinking more of them as being little teasers for an audience who would commission a finished watercolor to be made in the studio. And so frequently you see watercolors look almost exactly like one another. One is always smaller, and it's much more finished. It's much more detailed, much more descriptive. The vitality of the line and of the brush in the preparatory study, like 37, becomes something that's really a bit more staid in the studio watercolors. He thought those would be more saleable. And we can look through his work and sometimes match the preliminary study with the studio watercolor. They're not always identical, as in this case, here's three of Medina on the upper register and three studio works down below. He painted them very quickly, these studio works. He didn't like doing it. He thought it was just purely commercial work, and he actually labeled them, somewhat disrespectfully, the potboilers or the tyrants. He didn't like having to do it, but he thought he could make more money selling those, which were quite literally mass-produced. Do 30 at a time. In the case of Malti, did 26. He stopped before he got beyond that. He just couldn't do any more. And they always had this same relationship. If we go back to the on-site watercolor, this is the study, and this is dimensions. This is the studio work, and those are its dimensions. This is in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. And you see there's just a density of surface in the studio works. They still fetch very good prices at auction. I'm not sure the market agrees with me totally on an aesthetic judgment between the preliminary sketches and the finished ones. Now, an example of how he tried to market his work, we see here in the diary, after breakfast, to finish the last of the 26 small drawings intended to have been the 5-pound series. Those are the potboilers or the tyrants. They sold for £5. But it's clear they will not be bought, and I don't like, somehow, the selection of one or two, leaving the rest sent to begging. I'm nearly minded not to sell any. But people would perhaps come in and try to cherry pick the best ones. He didn't like that at all. Meanwhile, I routed out all the large room, that's the room, believe it is, gallery, and set the showroom in order. They came, good luck how they did come, from 12 until 6 p.m., about 50 in all, with what I hate, no end of dogs. He really didn't like dogs. He's always complaining about the dogs in this neighborhood in Slema, keeping them awake at night, almost as bad as the crashing sea. But no one even asked the price of a drawing, but Mrs. Park did buy an Ionian book. Now, this is the sketch that he made in the diary of the lower floor of his house with the gallery. This is a sketch that he made at the bottom of a letter written 3 years earlier to his friend Fortescue, where he shows the disposition of works in a similar gallery that has two long walls and a short wall. And they're triple hung. I mean, this would be a horror for modern curatorial studies, or I think most collectors would say this is kind of a little bit much. But just cheek to jowl, end to end, one after another, numbering them, and then there's a list below. It's not a price list, but it might as well be a list of what is what. And this was back in 63, and he did the same thing in Malta in 66, with really no effect at all. He had more dogs in the studio that day than he had sales. Now, the other point that Lear really was aiming towards, his highest goal, was oil painting. What he would really like is for you to come to his studio, see a preliminary sketch, say, I like that. I like that composition. I like that site. It's one of my favorite spots. Would you paint me an oil of it? Very few people made that request. In 1877, Lear compiled a list of his own of the 292 pictures that he had painted between 1840 and 77. Remember, he lives on until 88, and he was active until 1888, so there are more than 262. This list is useful. It was published in the first volume of Letters in 1907, because it only tells you where the year in which they were done, what they were representing, but also who bought them. So anyone doing provenance studies on Lear would just have a field day with these sheets, which are an appendix in the back of the second volume of Letters. Many of these works are no longer traceable, unfortunately. But we do have extant oil paintings. There are none, alas, in Malta that I know of really everywhere he went. Big oils in Italy, big oil in Greece, big oil in Albania, big oils from Corsica, very good market in Corsica. Here he is in Egypt. And finally, some of the most sublime work that Lear ever made was in the last decade of his life in India and Ceylon. But from Malta, we have one oil painting, or I might say we had one oil painting. It was published in the second edition of the Letters, Lady Strachey's Letters, and said to have been bought by Mr. Charles Roundell, and was at the time of the publication of that book, 1911, in the possession of his widow. Its current whereabouts are unknown, at least to me. If any of you find this painting, or maybe have the good fortune to own this painting, I would love to hear about it. But at the moment, all I can show you is a black and white of what was probably his favorite place on the entire Maltese experience. And that, of course, was Tachinch, and which he did. The preliminary study for this doesn't survive, but there are a number of studio works that survive. I think he thought this would be a hot seller. He also made little sketches in Letters saying, writing back to friends in England, how much he liked this place. And then later in life, when he was attempting to realize his lifelong ambition of illustrating the works of his friend Alfred Tennyson, the poet, he used Chinch as the model for the Palace of Art. This is number 38 of the list of poems. Lear, unfortunately, never got to see that published. Its publication for the Tennyson book was only published in 1889, the year after his death. In Gozo, he walked and drew and walked and drew. He had pretty good weather. He walked 15 to 20 miles a day. Coast scenery, and this is that famous line everyone around here has encountered so many times, is Pompsilius and Grumperiboris. He loved neologisms, which are bad enough when they're in English, but many of the things, the words he uses in Greek are also neologisms. I had three Greek translators throw up their hands at his Greek. I said, well, listen, just think of it as nonsense. Does that help? He said, oh, yeah, it does. So this is great neologism. This, of course, is a letter written after he left the island. And he suddenly gets very nostalgic about Malta once he's left. He's mainly unhappy with circumstances here because he's just not selling his work. If people have been flocking to a studio, or maybe if you tried a little bit harder to sell it to a broader range of client, things might have been very different. Gozo is also the only place he wrote a poem about, this too appended in a letter about the naughty isle of Calypso, Flipso, Hipso, Ripso, and Zipso, oh naughty Calypso. That is Lear at his absolute wittiest, the exact opposite of this cantankerous fellow that we encounter so often in other places. Now, I want to talk a bit, the last thing I'll say is about the style of Lear's work and ways he went about making pictures, which is in some respects a bit unusual. He's known as the Lord of the Horizon. Someone calls him that for his preference for rectangular horizontal formats, not vertical rectangles, but horizontal rectangles, which are much wider than they are tall. The predominance of his works, when you gather them all together and you try to look at them at one go, is they have a very pronounced directionality to them. And that directionality, almost invariably, with a couple of notable exceptions, reads from left to right. This is, of course, a truism of Western art in general. We read, those of us who speak the world's languages that do read from left to right. There are 7 languages in the world that do not read from left to right, but read right to left. Those people might find all this very dyslexic. But Lear's work generally reads from left to right. And the relationship that we have so accustomed to having since we were infants in the Western part of the world, the image text flow moves from left to right. Now, where do you find out information like this? You look up things like this, and you find a number of websites. They're directed to the parents of dyslexic children. How do you get your children to read from left to right? How do we reinforce that idea that we are a left-to-right civilization? And if there's a bit of text to help it along, the race is on is placed to the right side of the text. Everything about this image is moving from left to right. Reverse the image. You see how wrong it is? Now, Lear understood this intuitively. He's not a semiotician. He didn't read books that written unintelligibly by modern critics. But he understood this intuitively. And occasionally, there are works by Lear that reverse the directionality. And one of my favorite Lears is this one I've now shown a couple of times, which actually reads from a descending diagonal from the middle upper right to the middle upper left to the lower right. Try reversing this image and seeing how very different it is. Now, that's intentional on his part. This seems so correct, so easy. It's just such a no-brainer to picture the world that way. To picture it this way, where the major vehicle in this field is on your left, and then things fall away to the right, is a very compelling way to create an image. And if you have more time to look at more Lears, you'll see that he often did this. Never worked in the vertical format, always in this kind of format. His relationship to other artists should be mentioned. He's a painter of solitude. He paints very few people in his paintings. When he does, they don't have identities of any recognizable sort, unlike Schrantz and some of his contemporaries. Brockdorff have stormy seas, stormy skies, boats floundering, people looking over railings and so forth. Very, very few people in Lear. Maybe this is a reflection of his own sense of privacy and his own removal from the world. He really likes to be in isolated places. In the diary, he also complains often when he's set upon by small groups of boys who see him working in the field, say, "What are you doing, mister?" He really doesn't like that. Of course, he did like Malta over some places he went, because when he was in Islamic lands, he often found himself spat upon and had rocks thrown at him in Albania, for example. He was not happy there because people thought he was the Antichrist appearing, making these heathen images. So he preferred the Catholic countries. But he liked being off on his own this way. Now, probably the most celebrated, I don't think it's the best, but it's the most celebrated work ever painted the Grand Harbor is J.M. Turner's painting that hangs in the Museum of Fine Arts, which, as I think some of you probably are aware, was not painted in Malta. Turner never came to Malta. It was a bit of a deception. It's a bit like Stendhal writing his guidebook to Rome on a desk comfortably seated in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. This is Turner painting Malta from other views that he had access to. Now, one thing I found rather puzzling in looking at all of the Lears, and I was able to find over 100 of them, is his neglect of the ancient heritage on this island, which people for so long have been coming to see and to study. And it's not that these sites weren't excavated. They were indeed excavated by the time he was here. Tarshan hadn't been excavated quite yet. But in Gozo, Gigantia, and Hajj Arkim had been. And Lear seems to be indifferent to the echoes of the past. These are about the most boring watercolors that he painted. In fact, he must have found it so boring that he never even went to add color to this one. He just let it stay as a drawing. And in the diary, he describes the first building, a small Karnak or Stonehenge, and Gigantia, a vast, rude temple in fields of cultivation. He was quite insensitive to the past. He was not a romantic at spirit. Romantics would have just gobbled this up and talked about the slow corrosions of time and architecture as emblematic of human passage and fragility. Lear didn't go that way. So when you compare Lear with Belante or Brockdorff, you always find in one of them a peasant sort of sitting in the middle of the field, or a connoisseur or an archaeologist or a cicerone taking people around the site. This is stillness in Lear that it's really quite exceptional. Now, I'm going to end this talk by pointing out something which I think historiographically is important. The first exhibition ever held anywhere in the world of Edward Lear's work, and you saw all the places he'd been and how many places he'd traveled to, the first exhibition that was ever held of Edward Lear's work was held in Valletta in 1935. And there were some 73 watercolors, about half of which were of Malta itself. Fortunately, they're not illustrated. Unfortunately, we don't know who owned them, where they were borrowed from. It's a wonderful topic for somebody to pursue, I would think. And thus, I think it's particular significance that here, maybe right here, that the Fondazione in Palazzo Falson will be mounting this exhibition this fall, almost 80 years after that prime show that happened in 1935. Thank you.
John, that was fascinating and really a foretaste of what we're going to be seeing in October. And there's lots more, obviously, that hasn't been discussed tonight, but that you'll be revealing in your forthcoming book as well on Lear. So thank you for that.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Edward Lear in Malta, New Revelations. This talk was delivered by Professor John Variano.